Good evening, this is John St. Germain, the voice of the Crystal Silence League. It's January 5th, 2016, our first show of 2016. Happy New Year. We have a wonderful show tonight. We're exploring the Eightfold Noble Path of the Buddha. Tonight we're going to look into that very serious topic, a serious and fun topic. So stay with us. Grab your crystal balls. Have them handy. We're going to have our prayers coming up, our crystal of the week. Which is what? Let me check my notes here. Charoite, a wonderful crystal from Russia. And do join us after a little brief musical interlude, and we'll be right back. Well, I'm back. This is John St. Germain welcoming you to the Crystal Silence League Radio Hour, brought to you by Lucky Mojo Radio Network. And this is our first broadcast of the year, and I meant to have a little format change for you, but we didn't get around to it because, of course, we're very busy here. For those of you who don't know, and those of you who may be tuning in for the first time, the Crystal Silence League was formed around 1917 by Mr. Claude Conlon, who formed the Crystal Silence League to distribute and project positive affirmations and prayer for all those in need of such. And when Mr. Conlon passed into the silence around 1958, the Crystal Silence League went with him. But around 2011 or so, magical adepts of the Missionary Independent Spiritual Church revived it in cybernetic form, and you can find us on the internet at www.crystalsilenceleague.org. where you can post prayers. And of course, back in the old days, people would send their prayers to Mr. Conlon by postcard, and he would bring them out in big sacks and put his crystal ball on the stacks of postcards and prayers and pray via his crystal ball. We do it online now, and the pastors will send out 3 times a day positive prayers and affirmations, and members of the Crystal Silence League will receive them via crystal ball. It's a wonderful thing. We get hundreds of prayers per week, and it's been the custom since we started the show that I read aloud some of these prayers. I don't identify them by name, only by prayer ID. We remain anonymous. And I invite you to join me in praying for the following people. I only read aloud a few of these. We get hundreds of them. It would take all night to read even a day's worth of prayers. So let's start just a few of these. It's prayer ID number 45942, who prays that God touches his parents and grant the entire family salvation, good health, peace, and joy, and a certain miracle this person is praying for. Prayer ID number 45941, who prays to be reunited with the love of her life. And prayer ID number 45940, initials JM, prays that he or she finds an apprenticeship that will bring him or her the business and career and love and partnership that he or she dreams of. Prayer ID number 45939 thanks God, the universe, and the goddess Venus and the Holy Spirit to have this person, who I won't name, in his or her life, and thanks for answering the prayers, and wants their love to last for eternity. It's a prayer of gratitude. That's a very nice thing to have on our site. Prayer ID number 45938 prays for healing of his mother who has ovarian cancer and prays that she get well quickly. Prayer ID number 45936 needs help with finances. needs a financial miracle. Prayer ID number 45935 needs $300 to help with finances. Prayer ID number 45934 needs general help, apparently, for someone whose initial is M. Prayer ID number 45932 needs some heavenly gifts for people to his friend whose name begins with S. We also have prayer ID number 45931 is praying for someone whose initial begins with M. And we also have prayer ID number 45930 praying for someone whose initials begin with L. We have some vague prayers here that just pray for these people in general. Prayer ID number 45925 prays that someone whose initial is S comes back to them for it's a reconciliation to come back and love them the right way is what it says. Prayer ID number 45924 wants us to pray for her husband and her to reignite their marriage. Prayer ID number 45923 needs prayer for her teen daughter to be removed from evil influences. That's the end of our prayers for the day. Please join us in prayer in a moment of silence and prayer for all those in need of comfort and affirmation. Amen. Welcome to our first show of the new year, 2016. What a wonderful year it's going to be. And our gallery is full. Our studio audience is full. My gosh, why don't you come join us in chat? Come join us in our chat room. We always have lively conversation. I never get a chance to join in because I'm too busy consulting my notes and keeping our wacky control room going. Blog Talk Radio is always an adventure. In panic and last-minute fires that need to be put out and keeping the cybernetic web running. Our crystal of the evening is charoite, and try saying that six times really fast, charoite. And it comes from Russia. It wasn't discovered until fairly recently, around 1950 or something like that. And it comes from Siberia, which is an area associated with oppression and political prisoners. So it's become a symbol of enduring adverse conditions. It's a protective stone. It's a powerful stone to help protect you from attack of all kinds, psychic attack, physical attack, mental attack, and adversity. It grants courage. Owned by the performer Charo, yes, it's a hoochie-coochie stone. It helps you deal with loss, how to start over after you've lost a job or lost a house, or had your car repossessed. If you live in a depressed area, an area of high unemployment or if you're in prison, you know, in a boarding school, or if you're in a hospital, it can help you withstand these adverse situations. It's supposed to also help support you if you are in a difficult job, if you care for the ill or the infirm, or if you work with people with behavioral difficulties. It helps you deal with that. It's a home that supports you if you're away from home. If you live alone, if you're isolated with very little contact with others, it helps promote healing if you suffer from homesickness and loneliness and alienation, and it can ease your fears of such things, of being abandoned. Because it is mostly a purple stone, it's an interesting thing because it's a purplish-blue stone, so it connects the crown chakra and the third eye. It vibrates between two of them. So it can help awaken analytical abilities, observational abilities. It can help you think faster and make faster decisions. And it can help you if you have lots of work to do in a fast deadline to get them. It can help you with that. It can help you deal with dread of, you know, if things are coming up, disasters you can't prevent and you're dreading it and it paralyzes you, it can help you deal with that. I like that this, I'm going to get me a piece of it, this thing of huge amounts of work and a deadline coming up. I have one of those looming up ahead, so I think I'm going to get me a big pile of charoite. But it's a wonderful stone. Grand Mufti knows exactly what I'm talking about. Charoite. Hey, our topic tonight, the Eightfold Noble Path of the Buddha, and I'm very excited to talk about this. The Eightfold Noble Path is the way to end suffering. And what we find with people basically is that the search for a spiritual path begins with suffering. It's born out of suffering. The spiritual path doesn't start with candy falling out of the clouds and candy and ice cream and cotton candy falling out of the clouds, but with the hard attack of the world, pain, disappointment, confusion. This is where the spiritual path starts. Now, but for suffering to give birth to a genuine spiritual insight, it's got to be more than just something that you passively receive from without. You know, getting beat up by the world doesn't necessarily equate to a genuine spiritual search. There's got to be a catalyst of a genuine inner realization, a perception, which penetrates the our usual blah complacency with the world, to glimpse this yawning abyss that we're perpetually standing near, perpetual chasm underfoot. Now, when you get this insight, it may stick with you, or maybe just be for a moment. It may just be like that. It can precipitate a profound crisis, of spirit. All of our accustomed goals and values, our view of the world, preconceptions, everything we used to enjoy, everything we held onto, suddenly becomes unsatisfying. It loses meaning. You have an existential crisis. Now, usually these changes are not welcome. We fight them. It's counterintuitive. We try to deny what happened. We try to deny our vision. We smother our doubts. We sometimes bury ourselves into hedonism. We try to drive away this discontent with new pursuits, new pleasures. But this flame, once lit, of spiritual inquiry will continue to burn, and if we don't let ourselves be swept away by these superficial pleasures, and if we don't slouch back into, some kind of false optimism, originally that glimmer of insight will flare up again and again to confront us with this essential plight that the world is unsatisfactory. And it's precisely at that point, when every escape route is blocked, when we see there's no way out of this plight, that we're standing on the edge of this abyss, that we're ready to seek a way to bring this disquiet to an end. We can no longer continue to drift complacently through life, ignoring this. We can't be driven by our hunger for sense pleasures and by the pressure of social norms, this deep reality beckons to us. We've heard the call of the spiritual path. And until we arrive at some destination, we can't rest content. Once the spiritual bug bites you, man, you got to follow it. But then you find yourself facing a new difficulty. Once you find the need for a spiritual path, you discover that there's a whole bunch of them out there. And you also find, if you look into it, that spiritual teachings are by no means homogeneous and mutually compatible. When you browse through the library of humanity's spiritual teachings, both ancient and contemporary, and man, there's a new one that comes out every minute. We don't find one single tidy volume of spirituality that marks spirituality. This is the spiritual path. But there's a virtual infinite cornucopia of spiritual systems and disciplines, and every one of them says, this is the way. This is the fastest, the best, the quickest, the truest way to enlightenment. This is the ultimate. And confronted with this bewildering array of spiritual truths, we can fall into confusion trying to size them all up and to decide which one is truly liberating, which is the real solution to our needs, and which is a sidetrack, which one's a sidetrack with hidden flaws. Now, the most popular and easiest resolution to this problem is very popular, the eclectic solution. You pick and choose from various traditions, whichever seems practical and amenable to our predilections. You weld them together from different practices into a Frankenstein, or what I call a silly putty religion. The New Age was constructed this way. I hope I don't step on your toes, but that's exactly what New Age was. It came out of theosophy and was just welded together with a whole bunch of stuff. So you find a synthesis which is personally satisfying. So you can combine Buddhist meditation with Hindu mantra practice, with Christian prayer and Sufi dancing, and throw a little Jewish Kabbalah in there and Tibetan visualization exercises, and voila, you've got your own personal recipe. But eclecticism, while it can be helpful in making a transition from, let's say, a predominantly materialistic way of life to one that takes on a materialistic or a spiritual taste, will eventually wear thin. It's a comfortable resting point. It's a comfortable halfway house, but it is not suitable as a final vehicle. And I'm going to tell you why. There's two related flaws in eclecticism that will account to its ultimate defeat as a spiritual path. One is that eclecticism compromises the very traditions that it draws upon. All the great spiritual traditions themselves do not propose their disciplines as independent techniques that can be removed from their cultural settings and freely recombined to enhance the quality of our lives. In other words, they're not Lego. Religions are not Legos. You can't take pieces of Christianity and combine it with pieces of Sufism and combine that with pieces of Hinduism without damaging the whole. Religious systems are presented as an integral whole, a coherent vision regarding the fundamental nature of reality and the final goal of the spiritual quest. A spiritual tradition is not a shallow stream in which you can just wet your feet and then run to the shore when things get rough. A spiritual tradition is an ocean. It's like surfing a big tidal wave. And you rush through the entire landscape. You surf through the entire landscape of your life. And if you truly wish to travel on it, you got to be courageous enough to launch your raft and head out for surge out for the deepest depths of it. When you do eclecticism, you're wading in the shallows. You're not scuba diving into the depths. And the second defect in eclecticism arises from that first. Spiritual practices are built upon visions regarding the nature of reality and the final good. And these visions are not always mutually compatible. And if you honestly examine the teachings of great traditions, you find that major differences in perspective reveal themselves almost immediately. The Christianity and Buddhism, you know, Christianity teaches the final goal is to go to heaven. Buddhism says no, heaven is not the final goal. The final goal is to not have any of that. You know, what do you do with traditions that teach that you have an immortal soul and traditions that teach that you do not? You cannot. The end goals are entirely different. So you find differences that can't be easily dismissed as alternative ways of saying the same thing. Rather, these points of view point to very different experiences constituting the supreme goal, the ultimate, and the path that has to be trodden to reach that goal. When people tell me things like, well, all religions ultimately teach the same thing, I say, you've not read them, have you? You've not looked beyond the very shallow point, because all religions do not teach the same thing. They do not. Even the Abrahamic religions have different paths to achieve different goals. So because of these differences in perspectives and practices that the different spiritual traditions propose, once you outgrow eclecticism and you feel you're ready to make a serious commitment to one particular path, there's another challenge. Which path is the one that's going to lead you to your true goal? Which goal do you want? If you want to go to heaven, you know, you got to pick, you know, Christianity or a religion that teaches the path that leads to heaven. If you want enlightenment and liberation of suffering, you got to get one of those paths. You're looking at, you know, you're looking at Eastern religions at this point. So one clue to resolving this dilemma is to clarify your fundamental aim. What is your fundamental aim? And determine what you seek in a genuinely liberative path. And if you reflect carefully, it becomes clear that the prime requirement, for me anyway, and for if you think about it, is how do you end suffering? And all problems ultimately can be reduced to the problem of suffering. So what we need is a way that will end this problem finally and completely. Throwing money at it won't. Feeding the hungry won't end it. Curing disease won't end it. These are putting patches on the cause. Finally and completely, both those words are important. The path has to lead to a complete end of suffering, to an end of suffering in all of its forms, and to a final end of suffering, to bring suffering to an irreversible stop. Dying and going to heaven won't do that. It might for you, but suffering will ever exist. Now, so the next question is, how do you find such a path? A path that has the capacity to lead us to the full and final end of suffering. Until we actually follow a path to its goal, we can't know with certainty where it leads. And in order to follow a path to its goal, we've got to place complete trust in the efficacy of this path. You're not going to cross a bridge unless you know it's not going to fall apart on you. So the pursuit of the spiritual path is not like selecting a new set of clothes. It's a very serious business. You know, to select a new suit, you only have to try on a pair of pants and look in the mirror and say, okay, that suit is attractive. I look good in that suit. The choice of a spiritual path is closer to a marriage. You know, you want a partner for life. You want one whose companionship will prove as trustworthy and durable as the stars in the sky. So now that with this new dilemma, you think you've reached a dead end and conclude that you have nothing to guide us but personal inclination, or maybe you can flip a coin, or maybe you can ask, your friends or something, but you don't have to be as blind and uninformed as that, because there are guidelines. Since spiritual paths are generally presented in the framework of a total teaching, you know, throw out eclecticism, don't try to invent your own religion, we can evaluate the effectiveness of any particular path by investigating the teaching which expounds it. So in making that investigation, let's have three criteria. First, the teaching has to give a full and accurate picture of the range of suffering. If the picture of suffering it gives is incomplete or defective, then the path it sets forth will most likely be incomplete and defective. It won't be satisfactory. The second criteria calls for a correct analysis of the causes giving rise to suffering. The teaching can't stop with a survey of the outward symptoms, like hunger, disease, cruelty, It's got to give you the cause. It has to penetrate beneath the symptoms, the level of causes, and describe those causes accurately. And the third criterion is it pertains directly to the path itself. The path which the teaching offers has to remove suffering at its source. It's got to cut it off at the root. This means it has to provide a method to cut off suffering by eradicating the causes. If it fails to bring about this root-level solution, its value is ultimately worthless. So to sum up, three requirements for a teaching proposing to offer a true path to the end of suffering. It has to set forth a full and accurate picture of the range of suffering. It must present a correct analysis of the causes of suffering. And it must give us the means to eradicate the causes of suffering. Voila. It brings us to Buddhism. So it's not our purpose tonight to evaluate the various spiritual disciplines of the world in terms of these criteria. Not all of them have at their source the eradication of suffering. Our concern tonight is to discuss the Eightfold Noble Path, which is a viable vehicle for liberation of suffering. So we have to check it out against these three criteria, and we'll look at the Buddha's very account at the range of suffering, his analysis of his causes, and the paths he takes, offers as a remedy. Now, the Buddha didn't touch on the problem of suffering tangentially or indirectly. He made it the cornerstone of his teaching. The Four Noble Truths that sum up his message basically says the first noble truth is that life is inseparably tied to something he called dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A. The Pali word dukkha is often translated as suffering, but it means something deeper than pain and misery. It refers to a fundamental unsatisfactoriness running through life itself, the lives of all of us but the enlightened, those who have achieved bodhi. Sometimes this unsatisfactoriness erupts full-fledged into the open as sorrow, grief, disappointment, despair. But usually it hovers at the edge, just out of the edge of our awareness, as a vague, uncertain sense that things are never quite perfect. They're never fully adequate to our expectations of what they should be. And this very fact of dukkha is the only real spiritual problem. It's the only real spiritual problem. All these other problems, all these theological and metaphysical questions that have taunted religious thinkers for millennia, in a field of volumes, Buddha waves aside as matters not tending to liberation. He waves them aside. He says a lot of times they're wrong questions. What Buddha teaches is suffering and the ending of suffering, dukkha and its cessation. Now think about that. All these millions of questions, theological and metaphysical questions, the ontological problem, intelligent design problem, he waves it aside. He says those do not lead to liberation. He teaches suffering and the ending of suffering. That's what's important. Now, he doesn't stop with generalities. He goes on to expose, he lays it bare, the different forms that dukkha takes, both the evident and the very subtle. He starts with what's right there in front of your face, the suffering inherent in the physical process of life itself, shows up in birth, aging, and death. In our susceptibility to illness, accidents, injuries, hunger, thirst, and it appears again in our inner reactions to ugly situations and events, sorrow, anger, frustration, and fear aroused by painful separations, by unpleasant encounters, by the failure to get what we want. Even our pleasures, Buddha tells us, not immune from dukkha. They give us happiness while they last, but they don't last long. Eventually they pass away, and then we're sad. And when they go, the loss leaves us feeling deprived, unhappy. Our lives, for the most part, are strung out. They're little episodes between the thirst for pleasure and the fear of pain. And we pass our days running after pleasure and running away from pain. We seldom are at rest. We're seldom content. We're either running after pleasure or we're fleeing from pain. Real satisfaction seems somehow always out of reach, over there on the horizon. Then in the end we die, and we give up the very identity that we spent our whole lives building, trying to satisfy. We leave behind everything and everyone we love. Seems depressing, doesn't it? but it really isn't. But it gets worse. It gets worse. Death, according to the Buddha, does not bring us to the end of dukkha, for the life process doesn't stop with death. When life ends in one place, with one body, the breakup of the body, the mental continuum, which is called Bhagavad Gita, the individual stream of consciousness springs up again elsewhere with a new body as its physical support. And the cycle goes on and on and on, over and over. Birth, aging, death, birth, aging, death, driven by the thirst for more existence. This is called tanha, thirst. The Buddha declares that this round of rebirths called samsara, S-A-M-S-A-R-A, samsara, which translated is the wandering, has been turning like a wheel through beginningless time. Without a first point, without temporal origin, no one, no matter how far back in time you go, can remember it. You always find living beings, ourselves in previous lives, wandering from one state of existence to another. And in Buddhist literature, there's various realms where rebirth can take place. Realms of torment, the animal realm, the human realm, realms of celestial bliss, spirit realms. But none of those realms can offer a final refuge. There's no resting place. You wander from one to the next. Life in any plane must come to an end. It's an impermanent and thus marked with that insecurity, which is the deepest meaning of dukkha. And for this reason, one who aspires to the complete end of dukkha cannot rest content with any mundane achievement, no worldly achievement, no worldly status, but you must win emancipation from the entire unstable wandering that we call samsara. Samsara. Now, the causes of suffering. A teaching that says it's going to end suffering has to tell you what suffering is. So if you want to put a stop to suffering, you have to stop it where it begins with its causes. So Buddha said the truth of the origin of dukkha. A sizable proportion of his teachings was about what causes dukkha. And he locates it within ourselves, not outside, not the world, not the world. It's inside of ourselves. There's a fundamental illness, a malady that permeates our being, which causes all the disorder in our own minds and therefore in our relationships and therefore in the world. And the sign of this malady, this illness, can be seen in our tendency to maintain certain unwholesome mental states that are called kalesas, K-I-L-E-S-A-S, kalesas, usually translated as defilements or impurities. And the most basic defilements, and there's a whole list of them, but the most basic defilements are greed, aversion, and delusion. Greed is self-centered desire. It's desire turned inward, self-centered. The desire for pleasure and possessions, the desire for survival, the urge to bolster the sense of ego, the sense of I with power, status, and prestige. Aversion signifies, it's the response of negativity, of negation, which is rejection, irritation, condemnation, hatred, anger, violence. And delusion is mental darkness. It's the thick coat of lack of understanding, which blocks out clarity. So from these three roots emerge the various other defilements: conceit, jealousy, ambition, lethargy, sloth, arrogance, all the rest. And from all these defilements together, the roots come dukkha in its diverse forms: pain and sorrow, fear and discontent, which causes all the aimless drifting through the round of birth and death. To gain freedom from suffering, we have to eliminate the defilements. But the work of removing the defilements has to proceed in a methodical way. It can't be accomplished simply by an act of will, by saying, go away, by wanting them to go away. The work must be guided by investigation. And we have to find out what the defilements depend on, what their fuel is, remember, the fuel, and then see how it lies within our power to remove their fuel. Now, the Buddha teaches that there's one defilement which gives rise to all the others, one root that holds them all in place, and this root is ignorance. Avijja, A-V-I-J-J-A, avijja. Ignorance is not mere absence of knowledge, a lack of knowing particular pieces of information. ignorance can coexist with a great accumulation of knowledge, and in its own way, it can be shrewd and resourceful. Ignorance is the root of dukkha. It's a fundamental darkness shrouding the mind. Sometimes it's passive ignorance, which obscures correct understanding. Other times it's an active ignorance, which is a great deceiver. It conjures up a mass of distorted perceptions and conceptions, which the mind interprets as attributes of the world, unaware that they are its own deluded constructs. And it's in this ignorance that we find the soil that nurtures the defilements. The mind catches sight of some possibility of pleasure, accepts it at face value, and the result is greed. We mistake the pleasant, we mistake the unpleasant for the pleasant, and we get greedy for it. Our hunger for gratification is thwarted because it's not pleasant. It's impermanent. We mistake the impermanent for the permanent. Obstacles appear and upspring anger and aversion, or we struggle over ambiguities. Our vision clouds over. Our understanding becomes replaced by delusion. When we discover the breeding ground of dukkha, ignorance issuing in the defilements issuing in suffering. And as long as this causal process occurs, we're not yet beyond danger. We might still find pleasure and enjoyment, you know, sensual pleasures, social pleasures, pleasures of the mind and heart, but no matter how much pleasure we might experience, no matter how successful we might be at dodging pain, the basic problem remains forever. We continue to move within the bounds of dukkha. So to cut off these causes of sufferings, we have to eliminate it by the root, and that means to eliminate ignorance. But how do you do that? Well, all the answers to this are in the Eightfold Path, by the way, which we'll be looking at some point. But the answer follows from the nature of the enemy. Ignorance is a state of not knowing things as they really are. And so to cure that, you have to perceive things as they really are. And it's not conceptual knowledge. You can't read this in a book. It's not knowledge as idea or concept. It's not abstract knowledge, but it's perceptual knowledge. It's a knowing which is also a seeing. This kind of knowing is called wisdom, or panya, P-A-N-N-A, panya. Wisdom helps correct the distorting work of ignorance. This is wisdom that is direct knowledge. This is not wisdom that you get from ancient texts or from teachers. This is wisdom of direct knowledge. It enables us to grasp things as they are in reality, directly and immediately, free from preconceptions, ideas, views, and assumptions that our minds ordinarily set up between ourselves and the real. There's reality, and then there's these projections that get in the way of our perceptions of reality. We remove those projections, those delusions. We see reality as it really is. Boom, panya. To eliminate ignorance, we need wisdom. But how do you acquire this wisdom? Well, wisdom can't be gained by learning. It can't be learned by gathering, an arsenal of facts. But Buddha teaches that wisdom can be cultivated. It comes into being through a set of conditions. And these conditions, we have the power to develop. These conditions are mental factors. They're components of consciousness, which fit together into a systematic structure that can be called a path. In the word's essential meaning, a courseway for movement, a roadway leading to a goal. And the goal here is the end of suffering, and the path leading to it is known as the Eightfold Noble Path, with its eight factors: right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And this Eightfold Noble Path is called the Middle Way. Majjhima Patipada, Majjhima Patipada, Majjhima Patipada. It's called the Middle Way because it steers clear of two extremes, two misguided attempts to gain release from suffering. One is the extreme of indulgence in sense pleasures, the attempt to avoid pain by gratifying desire. This approach gives pleasure, but the enjoyment, one, is gross, impermanent, and devoid of deep contentment. The Buddha recognized this sensual desire can exercise a tight grip over the minds of human beings and was very aware of how attached people can become to the pleasures of the senses. His father, Buddha's father, surrounded him with the most wonderful pleasures because he didn't want his son to fulfill the prophecy of being the world's great Buddha. But it didn't work. Buddha knew that this pleasure is far inferior to the happiness that arises from renunciation, paradoxically, and therefore he repeatedly taught that the way to the ultimate eventually requires the relinquishment of sensual desire. Thus, the Buddha describes indulgences in sense pleasures as low, common, worldly, ignoble, not leading to the goal. So, you know, man, I do like chocolate ice cream, though. But it will never, ever lead you to liberation. The other extreme is the practice of self-mortification, which Buddha also... One day I'll read that to you, Buddha's attempts to gain liberation through both these extremes. The other extreme is the practice of self-mortification, the attempt to gain liberation by afflicting or torturing the body. It may stem from a genuine desire for deliverance, but it works within the wrong assumption that renders the energy expended barren of results. The error is taking the body to be the cause of bondage, when the real source of trouble is the mind obsessed by greed, aversion, and delusion. To rid the mind of these defilements, the affliction of the body is not only useless but self-defeating, for it's the impairment of a necessary instrument. Thus, the Buddha described the second extreme as painful, ignoble, not leading to the goal. And you see, this is a mistake also made by the flagellants, the medieval monks who would beat their body to whip it into submission. It wasn't the body that was the problem. It was the mind. So, completely apart and aloof from these two extreme approaches is the Noble Eightfold Path, called the Middle Way. Not in the sense that it is a compromise between the two extremes, but in the sense that it transcends them, both by avoiding the errors that each involves. The path avoids the extreme of sense indulgences by its recognition of the futility of desire and its stress on renunciation. Desire and sensuality, far from being means of happiness, are springs of suffering to be abandoned as the result, as the requisite of deliverance. But the practice of renunciation does not entail the tormenting of the body. It consists in mental training. And for this, the body must be fit. There must be a sturdy support for the inward work. The body must be well nourished and taken care of. Thus, the body is to be looked after, well, kept in good health, while the mental faculties are trained to generate the liberating wisdom. That's the middle way. That's the Noble Eightfold Path, which the Buddha said gives rise to vision, gives rise to knowledge, and leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. Let's take a moment for station identification, and we shall return with a little bit more of this wonderful and fascinating discussion of the Eightfold Noble Path.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, Kai Arman broadcasts On Sacred Ground, a tapestry of our times, comprising history, ethnography, and shamanism, featuring the voices of the land and the deceased, aided by scholars, spirit workers, and environmentalists. Kai's show airs from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. And on Saturday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Saturday nights from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
And we're back, discovering the Noble Eightfold Path of the Buddha. And I'm going to list those for you. They are divided into three divisions: wisdom, ethical conduct, and concentration. Wisdom, of course, is panna, P-A-N-N-A, and there's little wigglies over the last three letters. Ethical conduct, or sila, S-I-L-A, and concentration, or samadhi. And wisdom is right view and right intention. Ethical conduct, or sila, is right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And concentration is right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. To remember those, we used to say clems visa. C-L-E-M, concentration, mindfulness, effort, livelihood, visa, view, intention, speech, action. And they're not practiced in any specific order. They're not a steps you go. You don't practice right view, right intention, right speech, but you practice them more or less simultaneously, as far as possible, according to your capacity. They're all linked together, and they all help cultivate the others. But until you reach a certain degree, you're more or less going to practice them in some sequence. They're all used, and I'm going to tell you that they're all part, though, every one of them are all conditions of the practice of right concentration. I'm going to tell you that mindfulness is the key of all of them. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, and right concentration all require right mindfulness. So at the root of everything of the Eightfold Path, mindfulness is the key. Right concentration is meditation. It's meditation correctly. Right mindfulness is being mindful of your every action and thought. We will look very deeply into these over the next few programs. A practitioner who can practice right concentration more easily when right mindfulness is cultivated. Right effort is a concentrated focus of your efforts. Right understanding is understanding the Fourfold Noble Truths. Right speech is part of the, you find that right speech and right livelihood and these other things, this is part of the precepts. Right speech means you don't lie, you don't speak gossip, you don't have divisive speech, and you don't waste your words, you don't chatter. Right action is also part of the precepts. You don't kill, you don't lie, you don't cheat, you don't practice sexual misconduct, you don't practice intoxication. Right livelihood, this is having a livelihood that doesn't cause harm. And there are certain practices that are just right off the bat described as wrong livelihood: selling intoxicants, killing, anything involving killing, which means, you know, being a butcher, you know, hunting, selling firearms, selling weapons of any kind. There's some others. There's a list of it. Now, there's different wrong livelihoods. There's some things that monks are not supposed to do, and some things that laymen are not supposed to do, but laymen are not supposed to involve... Oh, you can't sell flesh. So you cannot sell animals, and you can't sell people. So if you owned a pet shop, for instance, that's a wrong livelihood. If you sell slaves, it's wrong livelihood. You can't, you know, you shouldn't be a butcher. You shouldn't kill animals for meat. Now, can you eat meat in Buddhism? According to Theravadan tradition, yes. It's okay to eat meat because you did not kill the animal. You're not killing the animal. You're eating a dead animal. The animal's already dead. You didn't kill it. And I know some people say that's splitting a moral hair, but you know, you really have to go into it. Right action, we talked about that. Right speech, right intention is a very interesting one. Right intention can be called right thought or right resolve or right conception, right aspiration. It's the exertion of your own will to change. You should constantly aspire to rid yourself of whatever qualities that you know to be wrong and immoral. And that means the renunciation of worldly things, a greater commitment to the spiritual path, the goodwill, the practicing of the paramitas, the blessed states, equanimity, loving kindness, metta, karuna, equanimity. You set your mind to right resolve, to correct thought. Right effort is right endeavor, right diligence. You make a persistent effort to abandon all the wrong and harmful thoughts, words, and deeds. Now, a lot of these may seem similar, but they're really not. They're really not. They're refinements of this. And I want to read to you the, or at least parts of the Nagara Sutta from the Pali Canon, the Samyutta Nikaya, which is the second book of the Pali Canon. This is from the Buddha's own words when he described how he discovered this. And the Buddha says, "Dwelling at Savatthi, monks, before my awakening, when I was just an unawakened bodhisattva, the realization came to me, how this world has fallen on difficulty. It is born, it ages, it dies. It falls away and re-arises, but it does not discern the escape from this stress, from this aging and death. Oh, when will it discern the escape from the stress, from this aging and death? Then the thought occurred to me, aging and death exist when what exists? From what, as a requisite condition, is there aging and death? From my appropriate attention, there came the breakthrough of discernment. Aging and death exist when birth exists. From birth, as a requisite condition, comes aging and death. Then the thought occurred to me, birth exists when what exists? From what is a requisite condition, comes birth. From my appropriate attention, there came this breakthrough of discernment. Birth exists when becoming exists. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. Name and form exists when what exists. From what is a requisite condition is their name and form. You see, he's going through dependent origination. This is when he discovered it. From my appropriate attention, there came the breakthrough of discernment. Name and form exists when consciousness exists. From consciousness as a requisite condition come name and form. Then the thought occurred to me, consciousness exists when what exists. From what as a requisite condition comes consciousness. From my appropriate attention, there came the breakthrough of discernment. Consciousness exists when name and form exists. From name and form as a requisite condition comes consciousness. Then the thought occurred to me, this consciousness turns back at name and form and goes no farther. It is to this extent that there is birth, aging, death, falling away, and re-arising. That is, from name and form as a requisite condition comes consciousness. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. From name and form as a requisite condition come the six sense media. Thus is the origination of this entire mass of stress, origination, origination. Vision arose, clear knowing arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regard to things never heard before." The Buddha is describing the moment of his illumination. "Then the thought occurred to me, aging and death don't exist when what doesn't exist. From the cessation of what comes the cessation of aging and death. From my appropriate attention, there came the breakthrough of discernment. Aging and death don't exist when birth doesn't exist. From the cessation of birth comes the cessation of aging and death. Name and form doesn't exist when what doesn't exist. From the cessation of what comes the cessation of name and form. From our appropriate attention, there came the breakthrough of discernment. Name and form doesn't exist when consciousness doesn't exist. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. Then the thought occurred to me, consciousness doesn't exist when what doesn't exist. From the cessation of what comes the cessation of consciousness. From my appropriate attention, there came the breakthrough of discernment. Consciousness doesn't exist when name and form doesn't exist. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of consciousness. The thought occurred to me, I have attained this path of awakening. That is, from the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of consciousness. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense media. From the cessation of the sixth sense media comes the cessation of contact. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging sustenance. From the cessation of clinging sustenance comes the cessation of becoming. From the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. From the cessation of birth, then aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair all cease. Thus is the cessation of this entire mass of stress, cessation, cessation. Vision arose, clear knowing arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regard to things never heard before. It is just as if a man traveling along a wilderness track were to see an ancient path, an ancient road, traveled by people of former times. He would follow it. Following it, he would see an ancient city, an ancient capital inhabited by people of former times, complete with parks, groves, and ponds, walled, delightful. He would go to address the king or the king's minister, saying, Sire, you should know that while traveling along a wilderness track, I saw an ancient path. I followed it. I saw an ancient city, an ancient capital, complete with parks, groves, and ponds, walled, delightful. Sire, rebuild that city. The king or king's minister would rebuild the city so that at a later date the city would become powerful, rich, and well-populated, fully grown and prosperous. In the same way, I saw an ancient path, an ancient road, traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones of former times. And what is that ancient path, that ancient road, traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones of former times? Just this noble eightfold path, right view, right aspiration, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. That is the ancient path, the ancient road, traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones of former times. I followed that path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of aging and death, direct knowledge of the origination of aging and death, direct knowledge of the cessation of aging and death, direct knowledge of the path leading to the cessation of aging and death. I followed that path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of birth, becoming, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the sixth sense media, name and form, consciousness, direct knowledge of the origination of consciousness, direct knowledge of the cessation of consciousness, direct knowledge of the path leading to the cessation of consciousness. I followed that path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of fabrications, direct knowledge of the origination of fabrications, direct knowledge of the cessation of fabrications, direct knowledge of the path leading to the cessation of fabrications. Knowing that directly, I've revealed it to monks, nuns, male lay followers, and female lay followers, so that this holy life has become powerful, rich, detailed, well-populated, widespread, proclaimed among celestial and human beings. Now there, in the Buddha's own words, is enlightenment and the path to enlightenment. And this one, this is the Nagara, N-A-G-A-R-A, Sutta, S-U-T-T-A, the city. And there is, there are several, there's hundreds of descriptions from different points of view where the Buddha describes his enlightenment. But this, in a nutshell, are every teaching described in a very compact form. Many of the suttas are this way. You need someone to unpack them. A lot of the suttas are condensed teachings, and you need a monk or someone of great knowledge to unpack them, which is what we've been doing for several weeks now. We've been unpacking these teachings. There you have it. This is the transition of Buddha from a mundane mind to the mind of a Buddha and the moment it happened. And so next week, good friends, we're going to take a break from this and we're going to pay tribute to one of our fallen heroes, a good friend of ours, Ron Martin Shank, who passed away recently. We're going to pay tribute to him. So join us next week. We're going to rebroadcast an interview that we had with him. And see you then.
Looking for a fun way to unwind and win real cash? We got you. Try Solitaire Cash. Play the game you love with exciting cash prizes. Winning feels simply amazing. Challenging yourself feels even better. Whether you're a Solitaire pro or just starting out, Solitaire Cash offers endless fun and real rewards. Join millions of like-minded players. Download the app and dive into the fun today. Solitaire Cash.
Play the game, play the game, play the game.
Winning is based on skill.
Ryan Seacrest here. When you have a busy schedule, it's important to maximize your downtime. One of the best ways to do that is by going to ChumbaCasino.com. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino games like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire that you can play for free for a chance to redeem some serious prizes. So hop on to ChumbaCasino.com now and live the Chumba life. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply.